Chapter 20. 2 minutes later, the Wraiths rode their winches down their lines to the floor, landing silently at the edge of the loading area. Jesmyn was first, landing in the shadow of one of the track columns, and she took a few moments to scan her surroundings before waving the others down. Coming to rest on the permacrete floor, Miri also scanned their surroundings. It was a large chamber, a motor pool by the looks of it. Most of it was a broad permacrete shelf with that gash of a metal trench running down its middle, dividing it in half. The trench continued north and south along the center of a broad, high, arch-topped corridor lit by ancient glow rod fixtures, many of them flickering with age and lack of maintenance. The corridor extended to the limits of Miri's vision in this gloom, and she could see doors, some human scale, and some 6 or 7 meters high and wide, dotting the walls every 20 to 30 meters. She also thought she glimpsed cross corridors in either direction. The vehicles around her, she saw full-sized plasma artillery batteries, modern units that rode easily on repulsor lifts. There were hauler land speeders, expensive personal air speeders, speeder bikes, and armored personnel speeders. There were no people to be seen, and the place was eerily quiet. The only noise came from the lift car, now reaching the top of the shaft. The Wraiths tied their cords off to metal rings at the base of one of the columns, then gathered in the deepest shadows which were on the wall beneath the abandoned residential level. Bindi looked around at the bounty of the motor pool and shrugged.
We've won. We're not out of here yet.
Miri didn't know whether or not to be appalled at Bindi's assumption of victory.
True, but look, artillery units. I'll give you 100-1 odds that they were reported destroyed in field exercises. Now they're going to the black market. All that Bacta? Why is it so empty?
Though his whisper could not carry much emotion, Trey sounded distracted, bothered.
Why was the topside floor pulled out? We'll find out. Ortis.
She pointed to Termin.
He gets all the explosives with comm-based detonators, the simple ones. 4. Check him out on them to make sure he knows how not to blow himself up. 2. He'll stay here in this chamber and put charges beneath the repulsor motivators on as many of these vehicles as you can. Military vehicles first. As we leave, we'll set him off so they can't fly the evidence away on short notice. Then 4, you and 3 check out everything interesting to the south, while 5 and I do the same to the north. Record everything. Don't get caught. We'll muster back here in an hour. Clear?
Miri nodded.
Clear.
But her confirmation did nothing to diminish the unease she felt. Miri crept with Trey a few dozen meters down the south corridor. They peered into the first doorway, an open rectangle of black, and within it saw only a storeroom whose shelves held crates of food. Cereal products, dried fruits, sweeteners, powders meant to be mixed with drinks.
I need to check this out.
Trey turned his back on the storage room and moved in a crouch over to the trench. He slipped down into it, disappearing from Miri's view. She followed, landing beside him in the shadowy gap.
I told you, I know what it's for.
Yes, you did. And you were right.
Trey gave her an enigmatic look. Enigmatic only because she couldn't see his face and interpret his whole expression.
But do you know everything it's for?
He pointed to the trench side, which was beneath an overhang perhaps 10 centimeters deep. He flicked on the glow rod in his hand, illuminating a section of metal trench wall.
See those bolts? They're securing a panel 1 meter wide, 1 meter tall.
Miri nodded.
Sure. A panel to an access tunnel, under the permacrete floor. Probably a lot of them. Some will handle drainage, some will give access to infrastructure machinery. As empty as this place is, I bet many of them aren't ever looked in. When we pull out, we ought to leave one of us behind to continue surveillance. Our evidence will be a lot stronger if we do. Tell leader.
I will.
He crawled southward, keeping well below the trench lip above. Miri followed, occasionally peeking up above the rim to see her surroundings.
My father was on the Death Star trench run. You know, the famous one. Me, I get the general's basement trench crawl.
Miri couldn't see his face, but Trey's shoulders seemed to stiffen.
I know who your father is. Everyone knows who your father is.
I beg your pardon?
She looked at him, startled.
Some of us don't have famous relatives to admire, or non-famous relatives to admire.
I didn't mean it that way. It was a joke.
All right.
Jesmyn and Bindi kept to the shadows along the wall when they were deep enough, switching to the trench when they were not. The two worked their way northward. In short order, they passed a succession of doors into darkened areas on either wall.
So quiet.
Bindi raised her head a little from the trench and looked around before ducking again.
I hear distant voices and music. Recorded music, I think. Echoing.
Jesmyn peered under the lip of the trench. With one gloved hand, she reached for the lump she saw adhering there and tugged at it, levering it free of the metal above. It came loose with a faint ripping noise, and she presented it to Bindi. It was an irregular mass, centimeters thick, of some material Bindi obviously couldn't at first make out. Layers of different colors. White and tan and gray and black. Bindi peered more closely at it.
Paint.
Jesmyn squeezed it in her hand, causing the edges to buckle, warp, and peel away.
Scores or hundreds of layers.
She sniffed at it, detected the dim smell of solvents and Durasteel treatments.
This complex is very old.
Bindi's eyebrows rose, disappearing under her hood.
I know what this place is. Enlighten me. A tech raider's base. The Black Mucketeers from long ago. Thal and his original pop dogs hid out in one of their bases near the city of Vanguard to do their guerrilla activities against the Yuuzhan Vong.
While I was flitting all over the galaxy with your dad and Piggy and the other wraiths, Thal was squatting in a place like this, and harming the enemy his own way. But not from this base. This one doesn't appear in his history anywhere.
Bindi blinked, considering.
That would explain why he had Phalia base built so far from Vanguard and the old clone trooper facilities. He wanted to be conveniently near here. His own black market staging area.
Jesmyn offered her a nearly silent whistle.
He found more than one base and never reported it. He's been corrupt ever since the end of the Yuuzhan Vong War. At least. I wonder.
Bindi shifted as she thought.
Maybe there were still some old tech raiders here when he arrived. They might have helped him learn the lay of the land, taught him smuggler stealth techniques, and convinced him to become one of them. Maybe his pop dogs are tech raiders of a new generation.
Jesmyn nodded.
And maybe Thal is just the man to put them through a massive expansion, make them a galactic-class crime syndicate.
The first two chambers Jesmyn and Bindi examined turned out to be dormitories, each occupied by a dozen bunk beds now shrouded in transparent flexiplast, dust collected in a thin layer on all surfaces. The third chamber, on the far side of the trench, was free of dust. Bindi slid the corridor door shut behind her and switched the door side control panel so that the glow rods overhead would stay shut off, even though there were people in the room. Then the two women moved from shelving rack to shelving rack, navigating by the light from their glow rods, looking at what was warehoused there. High-grade military specification electronic parts, repair and replacement components for comm systems, sensor systems, and power generators. Opaque black transport cases marked only with the dates they were sealed. The planet of origin on each was shown as Kessel. Bindi actually seemed to pale in the light from Jesmyn's glow rod.
Glitterstim cases,
she told Jesmyn. Several shelves held Bacta, lots of Bacta, black and pink cylinders identical to those loaded on the airspeeder. Each cask of the miracle healing drug was clearly marked with the name of a military base. Most numerous were those marked Phalia Army Base, Vandor 3. and on nearby shelves were crimson casks marked Viridium and Ambori. Suddenly tired, Jesmyn rested her forehead against one shelf. Bindi moved closer.
Five, you look like you want to cry.
I do.
Jesmyn drew a couple of ragged breaths, trying to get control of herself.
I'm not familiar with... what are they? Viridium and Ambori?
Bindi frowned.
Mix them together and they offer up the chemical cues that Tess used to determine if a fluid contains Bacta. Mix them with an inert pink fluid medium and they look just like Bacta. And so those two drugs are part of what is referred to as the Bacta three-way, or the Bacta triangle scam.
Bindi shook her head.
I haven't heard of that one. Pretty much confined to the black market. It's a triangle because it's a three-component scam. You need new Bacta, and Bacta nearing the end of its useful life, and quantities of these two chemicals. Say you're the receiving officer for supplies at a hospital or military base. New Bacta comes in. You take the new Bacta and pour it all into containers marked as something else. Then you sneak them out of storage and sell them on the black market. You take the old Bacta and put it in the new Bacta containers. And you put the Viridium Ambori inert compound mix in the containers that are supposed to hold the old Bacta. When those containers go through their periodic tests, one test confirms that they're Bacta, but a second test indicates that they're past their effectiveness and should be destroyed.
Oh.
And it's worse even than just stealing a hospital's Bacta. Because anywhere this scam is run, the medics requisition a cask of new Bacta. It's sent up, used on a patient or in a crisis like the aftermath of a battle, a bunch of patients. The patient sickens or dies. Because in the meantime, that batch, which is actually old Bacta, has gone bad. People die.
Jesmyn turned away for a moment so Bindi would not see her face.
My friend was murdered while looking into an instance of that exact scam during the last war.
I'm sorry.
The door slid open. Jesmyn looked in that direction. A pop dog, a data pad in his hand, walked in. The man, a Twi'lek, his skin blue and his brain tails hanging loose, approached the aisle where the Wraith stood. He did not look their way at first. Then the door slid shut, plunging the chamber into blackness.
Stang!
There was a clank as the pop dog, probably turning back toward the door, hit a metal shelf. A duroplast object clattered on the floor. Jesmyn fixed the scene, everything she had seen just before the room went black in her mind. She darted up the aisle, brushing past Bindi, and turned where she thought the intersection to the Twi'lek's aisle was. She was right. She dashed forward, unimpeded. Then she ran into him. He seemed to have grown shorter in 3 seconds. He barely came up to her waist, and she tripped over him, crashing headfirst down on the hard floor. The thick ambient suit hood cushioned the impact, but she still saw little pinpoints of light dance around in the darkness like embers drifting up off a fire.
Who's that? Who's there?
The Twi'lek moved forward, stumbled across Jesmyn in turn, and slammed down on top of her. She grabbed at him, found his neck, tried to catch him in a chokehold, but one of his brain tails impeded her. A shaft of light blinded Jesmyn. Then there was a familiar sound, a blaster being fired. The entire chamber illuminated for a moment, blue light flickering across the Twi'lek's chest, Bindi silhouetted by light from her own shot. Then the Twi'lek went limp, and the chamber went dark again. Jesmyn froze, listening. All she heard was Bindi's breathing. Then Bindi's voice.
Five? Here.
She rolled the Twi'lek off her and rose. By memory, she moved to the door. It opened at her approach, allowing light to pour in. Cautious, she leaned out, looked both ways. There was no one in sight. She withdrew, and when the door closed, she adjusted the wall switch to disable the door's proximity sensor. She turned back toward Bindi, who now stood in the light cast by her own glow rod.
I'm sorry.
Not your fault.
Yes, it was. I got emotional. Clouded my ability to sense others. My fault.
She moved to grab the unconscious pop dog and drag him to the back of the chamber.
I'll tie him up. You record everything.
In a darkened warehouse chamber toward the southern end of the installation, Miri stared at the shelves full of blaster rifle cases, power pack cases, grenade crates. For someone like Miri, who liked her mayhem occasional but loud, the chamber was a playroom of unrealized promise. Then she noticed that Trey had stopped talking. Instead, he was leaning forward, his forehead pressed against a heavy-duty locking transparisteel cabinet. Miri moved until she could see his face.
Four, you suddenly look like you want to cry.
I do.
He stepped back from the cabinet and shone his glow rod on its contents. The cabinet had two shelves, themselves transparisteel. On the top shelf were two silvery bowl-like stands, and in each rested a globe larger than a bald human fist, a globe with dials and a depressible button. Miri stared at them for a moment, then clamped her hand over her mouth to suppress a gasp.
Thermal detonators! Two of them!
Trey's voice was almost rapturous.
Two! I have to steal these.
Is there security on that cabinet?
It looks like, yes. Really good security, too.
Trey peered at the locking mechanism, which was made of Durasteel and not transparent. He crouched to give it a good look.
You just want them for yourself.
He stood up, put a finger to his lips, and walked as quietly as possible to join her. He turned her toward the exit door and preceded her there. He slid the door open manually. They'd taken a moment to disengage its proximity sensor, scanned the main corridor beyond, and let her out. Only when the door was shut again did he speak.
There was a listening device in the case's security system.
Miri felt a chill pass through her.
So base security is already on to us.
I don't think so. That type of device isn't very sophisticated. I bet it just noted that someone was talking in the vicinity of the case and broadcast that fact to the central security computer. It dropped a flag saying, that was a little odd.
Miri blew out a breath of relief.
But not until enough flags are dropped around the base.
Does the computer say things are getting stranger? I'd better wake everybody up.
Let's not drop any more flags.
Good idea, Three.
Continuing on, they found more warehouses, both of them empty and dusty, and a dormitory block, two large chambers for men, one for women, both dark but sparsely occupied. Miri could hear the regular breathing of sleepers within. One door farther on led to a communal refresher. Miri could hear the hiss and feel the flow of moist air from an old-fashioned water sprayer. The old base had nothing so modern as a sanisteam. She and Trey crept past, not alerting whatever soldier was within. In the last cross corridor before the main hall ended, they discovered the cell block. It wasn't a big tunnel, only 3 meters wide and three tall, lined with metal doors. Each door had a metal crossbeam at waist height and a metal mesh grate, through which some air and light could pass at head height. Only one door, the one farthest from the main corridor, was lit from within. Trey checked his chrono.
Almost time to rendezvous. And we have the proof we need. Private ownership of thermal detonators is kind of illegal. Suggests terroristic impulses.
Look, all our recordings can't explain why we've only had to duck two pop dogs while exploring this whole wing. Why we keep finding sealed off empty dormitories and officers' quarters. The farther we get away from the central shaft, the emptier the place is. Why?
Because nobody wants to live close to a pair of thermal detonators?
Nice answer. But I want some confirmation. The kind of confirmation only a willing witness can give us. Like a prisoner.
Trey sighed.
Ugh. Let's make this fast.
They moved silently up the corridor and paused outside the door that showed light from the room beyond. Both took long moments examining the door exterior, the surrounding walls for holocams and audio pickups, but there were none. In fact, the entire arrangement here looked primitive. Doorway carved by long-ago lasers out of living stone. Doors and fittings made from heavy, armor-quality Durasteel. While Trey looked over the door's locking mechanism, a large metal lock, crude but effective, it clamped down over the center of the metal crossbar that held the door in place. Miri stood on tiptoes to peer through the metal grate. Yes, the chamber was lit inside, and Miri could see two stuffed chairs, a low table between them, a gridded game board on the table. In each chair sat a man, both Duros males with large black eyes and gray features. One of them glanced up to look at the door just as Miri caught sight of him. She ducked down again. A voice, thin but musical, floated out through the grate.
"Who's out there?"
Trey glared up at Miri.
"Stealth not being one of your skills. For I notice you never go on intrusions with the same member of the team twice. Diplomacy not being one of your skills."
Miri stretched on tiptoes again and brought her mouth close to the grate. Her reply was a whisper.
"Be quiet if you want to live."
"Very well."
Trey made a faint noise of disgust.
"Ugh, these guys make me sick. The jailers, I mean. This is a low-tech nightmare. No electronic security on it at all. The lock and the end caps keep the bar from being moved. The keyhole is for a huge, simple metal key. Ordinary lockpicks won't budge the mechanism. And if I can get it unlocked, the bar's got to weigh 150 kilos. The pop dogs must use a lifter droid to move it."
Miri put some sweet-sounding mockery into her voice.
"Big, strong man like you. You can clean and jerk 150. "Of course I can, but I was thinking about someone of more average abilities. You, for instance." "Oh, you'll pay for that. If I had Five's lightsaber, I could cut through this in 60 seconds. Just unlock the door, Four." "Yeah, yeah."
Trey thought about it for a moment, then pulled his vibroblade out of a waist sheath.
"Give me your blade." "You've got yours." "I need both to disassemble."
"Oh." She drew her weapon from its sheath and handed it to him. While Miri watched both him and the surrounding corridor, Trey took apart the vibroblades, separating the metal blade components, which could still stab and cut with reduced efficiency, even if the weapon's ultrasonic augmenter or battery failed, from the electronics. He slid both blades into the key aperture and began prying and twisting with them. 2 minutes later, there was a clunk. Too loud by far for Miri's taste, and Trey withdrew the blades, which were now bent and scarred, their edges ruined. He dropped them into his pack and flipped up the main body of the lock so that it no longer held the bar. He stood and bent to grip the metal bar, both his hands cupped along its underside.
He straightened with a grunt, heaving the bar clear of its brackets, and carried it a few meters along the wall. With similar care, he set it down again, making less noise than the lock had.
Miri drew her blaster. She waited until Trey had done the same. Then, cautious, she pulled the cell door open. Bright glow rod light poured out. Her quick glimpse showed social room furnishings, side tables loaded with computer equipment. The chairs, their occupants, and the game table had not changed. The Duros men stared at Miri with their big, dark, alien eyes, their faces schooled into expressionlessness. Miri entered the chamber. From her new vantage point, she could see side doors that probably led to auxiliary chambers. Trey entered behind her, pulled the door shut, and pressed his face against the grate to keep an eye on the exterior. Miri lowered her blaster just enough that she was not pointing directly at either Duros. The men wore orange and yellow striped jumpsuits, easy to see in any environment, suitable for prisoners. Miri knew a little about Duros' physiology, enough at least to distinguish age. She turned to the older man, recognizable as such by the extra wrinkling of his face, his slightly more sallow complexion.
"Who are you?"
"My name is Usan Joyal. Who are you?"
Miri felt her jaw drop.
"Usan Joyal?"
The Duro shook his head.
"No, that's me."
Trey glanced back in their direction.
"Who's Usan Joyal?"
"I am."
He's...
Miri felt herself on the verge of stammering. She tried to clamp down on her emotions. She'd grown up surrounded by famous people, but most of them weren't artists.
"He's...
a master of false identity preparation. Maybe the most famous one alive. Though we didn't know for sure that he was alive. He disappeared years ago. We'd assumed he'd made himself a new identity and retired.
The Duros kept his voice pleasant.
I'll never retire. I'll die before I retire. But I'm only famous within certain societies. Who are you?
I'm a protege of Booster Tarek. I was named for his daughter. I own 6 fleecing records on the Errant Venture.
Ah.
Usan Joyal at last sounded satisfied. He stood, bowed, sat again.
Allow me to present my grandson, Dashan. He is as adept as I was when I was 4.
The younger Dural snapped his head around to stare at the older. Miri thought he was glaring, but he merely said,
You'd been to jail twice by the time you were my age. My record is clean.
Things were different then, child.
Usan turned back to Miri.
Can we offer you some calf?
No. I assume you're a prisoner of General Thal. Can I offer you some escape?